Hello, you're listening to Living Alone Together. I am your only host, Yen. So first of all, I'm very grateful that this month, we've got one extra day. So at least on paper, it seems like I'm updating at least twice per month. So that's good. I was quite disheartened the other day when I found out that my podcast is classified as a monthly podcast on one of the platforms. I used to think of my podcast as a weekly podcast. Obviously that's not true anymore, but at least it's a bi-weekly thing. But one of the platforms just made it a monthly podcast, so that's very disheartening, and I will do my best to change that depiction. However, I do have to admit, this episode is gonna be a sort of like, it would feel like a forced episode. I mean, because it is a forced episode, I have to admit. But it doesn't matter, I'm happy recording this. I think my mind has somehow been changed since coming back from Finland. And I can't really put my finger on what is it. I do still think about Finland a lot. I don't know why. I think partly it's because it's such a slow and peaceful place for me. When I use slow, I don't mean it in a derogative way. It's just how it feels, and actually it's quite positive for me that to call it a slow place. And the thing about Finland being slow, and I was thinking about why it feels slow. First of all, I think it's the low population density. So based on, the country is quite big and you've only got 5 million people living there. So density is quite low. And it's not like, let's say, Canada, where a sizable community is in Toronto and Vancouver. And then so these two places could still be quite crowded despite the big land, the vast land and the low population relative to other places. And Finland isn't like that. Helsinki's got a population of 600,000, and that is really not that gigantic. It's quite small as a city, and then you've got various towns here and there, and they add up to the 5 million. But there's no one place that feels like a metropolitan. So I think that has to do with it, the feeling of being just more calm and not very crowded. The Helsinki city center is also quite walkable. I guess you could hit all of the places to see and things to do in just one day. And if you're a tourist, I would say two days in Helsinki would be quite enough, more than enough. And then you could hit some of the towns in the north, somewhere else. But what I'm trying to say is just that the communities are quite centralized, and the city itself just feels just not that busy. So that's good. That's really good. Not that busy, but you still have things to do, like cafes, and they've got great coffee. I wish I'd spend more time in cafes, you know. When I travel to a new place, I typically try to find some of the cafes to just stay there and observe and read, maybe, and do the usual stuff I always do. But this time in Helsinki, I decided to change. I was thinking, okay, it sounds a little bit boring. Maybe this time I shouldn't do all that cafe stuff. And I regretted it a little bit. I ended up only going to one cafe, and it was just, the coffee was great. I bought some, like a pack of coffee beans back home, and it's just great coffee. Anyway, about Finland feeling slow, it's not just the density. I think the fact that there was ice everywhere, that also changed things. So if on Google Map it says that it takes you 5 minutes to walk from one destination to another, in real life, for me at least, it means a 15-minute walk, because I would, you know, I'm very, very careful when it comes to walking on ice, and I would spend like three times the normal time walking just to make sure I don't fall. And I think that obviously slows things down, quite literally. Another thing that has to do with the slowness is the walking on ice as well, because when you just stare at your feet all the time, you don't have that much energy for the surroundings. And as stupid as that sounds, it actually it helps you focus, you know, and it's, you're just not so distracted, and you feel like there's like a filter. The ice and the snow are the filter for your distractions. So that's great. That's why it felt quite slow in Finland. And another element is, I think, the element of language. So Finnish is a completely foreign language to me. As in, I learned a bit of French and a little bit of German at school. So yes, I'm not good at them, but at least you can pick up just a little bit of phrases. And you don't feel completely relaxed when you could hear people speaking, and you sort of catch one or two phrases in like a million words. But still, it's different when it's a language like Finnish, where you've got zero idea what they're talking about, and you won't. I think it's how the brain works. Like if it's a language where you know like 5% of the words, or you're at A1 level, your brain would actively try to capture the information even when you're not actually interested in people's conversation. It's just how it works. And I think that's why you can't really listen to a podcast while reading a book in the same language. For me, it's easier if I'm reading a book in one language and listening to a podcast in another language, because your brain would be working, I think, differently for these two different purposes and different languages. But if it's the same language, you know, the brain will try to, I think it probably uses the same sort of mechanism of understanding. So anyway, that's a different topic, maybe for another podcast, or definitely requires some sort of research. But the point is, I think once you learn a little bit about any language, it's difficult to block out all the information. It's no longer that relaxing, because then it's not something you can control, you know. I think if you're familiar just even with a little bit with that language, your brain is just gonna give you some more noise. So Finnish I know 0% about, so that's very good. And you know, the bad thing is like, if you're exposed enough to a language, somehow your brain will pick up some information. So I learned without looking into the dictionary that the word katu in Finnish means street, because it's everywhere. Like all the bus stops have something something katu, so it means something something street. And so you know, when that happened, I was a little bit upset, because it means that the more you stay there, the more words are going to appear to be familiar to you, and then it's no longer going to be a strange land, and you're no longer a stranger in a strange land. So that's not very pleasant. But the point is, since it's only 1 week, at least I could, you know, the language barrier effect still exists for me, and so I feel pretty much at rest all the time. Like I didn't understand a thing, and it was just it's not even filled with English, you know. I think a lot of places they've got Finnish and Swedish written on the signs, but not English. So that is good, because nowadays, even in, let's say, like in a non-Indo-European country, Japan, Korea, a lot of places, they would have like an English sign, which could be convenient, but then it means that it's something you understand, so it's not very exotic anymore. By the way, Finnish is actually also not Indo-European, which is something I learned during this trip. in any case, so it's good that mostly they only have Finnish and Swedish written side by side, no English, so no need to decipher the information, no need to find excuse for not looking up the information because it's just something completely foreign. So that is why it felt quite slow to me. It's just a lot of factors working together that makes you feel very much relaxed. So I think I have like this new idea that in the future, if I'm going to travel, I want to go to a place where I know 0% of the language. I think that really, really helps because the point of traveling for me is to relax. But if you know too much, if you know something of the language, you're going to get distracted and you're going to take in too much information. So I'm going to go to a place where it's completely inconvenient, or rather the opposite, so convenient and very advanced, but language being completely foreign, so that my mind could just relax a little bit. So maybe like Russia or I don't know, like Hungary, where it isn't, like the language is completely foreign, but nowhere where you would have a lot of English around. I think that's a good idea. A lot of people might want to learn a little bit of like the language before they travel, but I just think, you know, it's not the kind of experience I want for me. It's about just losing myself and just having no opinion and getting no information whatsoever. So that's my experience with feeling slow, and that I have brought that back to where I am right now. Obviously the environment is very different, but I think in a way my mind has retuned itself to being a bit slower, as in not feeling the need to think about so many things at the same time and to just normalize doing one or two things in a day. And I think that's a good development. Like, I hope this doesn't go away ever. And I think I want to do this for the rest of my life, namely not being so anxious to do that stuff, or not being so guilty for not doing so many things. This actually reminds me of something I wanted to do for this month, or rather the next episode I wanted to do, which is talking about a book. So I haven't done any of the book talk. So one book I read recently, which was actually quite good, is called 4,000 Weeks. So maybe we can do a little bit of sneak peek into this book. So please don't shut this down just because it sounds like a self-help book. It's sort of, but it's not exactly that. So the book is called 4,000 Weeks, and it actually ties right into what I was talking about of feeling slow. But anyway, it's called 4,000 Weeks, and the writer is called Oliver Berkerman. And this book is really not about being productive, and so it felt quite different. I found out about this book on a subreddit called Simple Living. So Simple Living is a sub that really talks about the attitude behind simple living. It's not really about minimalism or anti-consumption, nothing like that. It's really, I don't really read it that much, but I came across this post about books that are about simple living, which is to sort of tune down your inner voice and outer environment voice one way or another. So they recommended this book, and I decided to take a look, and it turned out to be quite good. So the most interesting concept in the book is that we shouldn't think of time as a resource, and we should ditch this concept so that we have a different perspective on our lives completely. So time is not a resource that you can just use or have and preserve or save. It's nothing like that. It is not money. It's not, you cannot really equate these two things or exchange these two things. Time should be thought of as your being altogether. So you are time in a way. And that is, I think, the central premise of the book. And once you adapt this kind of thinking about time, the author proposes that basically you will be happier. So yes, I think in general, if a book says something, you know, gives out a theory, and if you adapt that theory, you'll be happier. If that's the backbone or the foundation of a book, then I suppose it's roughly a self-help book. But whatever, it doesn't really matter. It was a good book anyway. So I think that concept, it was really helpful for me to think of time as something, as not a resource. You know, if it's a resource, you have that anxiety to preserve it, to keep it, to save time, and to do things to produce more time. So this book is sort of anti productivity in that sense, because it promotes this new concept or new perspective on time that does not allow for squeezing as many things in an hour as possible. You know, it doesn't allow for that kind of pro-productivity lifestyle. And that's all based on the concept of time. And he gives out a lot of examples of how often when we treat time as a resource, it's gonna do more harm to our mental health than good. And often it's a case that when we start to feel like it's a resource, we get that pressure to do more things. And yet he gives a lot of examples on how when we try to squeeze more things, the list is just going to grow and grow, and it's going to be more and more dissatisfying for yourself when you realize that there's no way I could do all the things I want to do. And so in a way, he's trying to I guess prove that time indeed is not a resource, because if it's a resource, then we should have, like, the tools we have now should satisfactorily conquer time in that way. Like, we are so advanced with our tools to manage our time that ideally we should be at the point where we would be happy with our, you know, all the tools, and then we, and the fact that we can in so many ways manage, quote unquote, manage time, we should feel content. But the reality is the opposite, where we feel more and more increasingly useless for our inability to manage time, when the fact seems to be that no, we've developed more and more tools and habits to manage time, then how come we're feeling more and more dissatisfied with our ability? So that is sort of a conundrum, and he's trying to explain that the reason for this dissatisfaction is precisely that the premise is wrong, that time is not a resource. It is not something that we could tangibly manage, you know. So that is an interesting perspective, because I'm definitely one of the people who wanted to, you know, I'm used to the narrative that time is a resource. So that's the most interesting point in the book. And then based on that, he sort of goes on and talks about the alternatives of viewing time, and based on these alternatives, how we could in a way live happier. That's the gist of the book. And I just think that there are some great ideas in there. The only thing that's a bit disappointing, let's say, is that in the end it's still about trying to be better, and so that makes it roughly still a self-help book. But you can disregard that part and just take the advice with a grain of salt. But more or less, I do like the premise that because time is who we are, how we use time, you know, time isn't a means to an end. Time is an end in itself, because it is our being. Our being is not a means to an end, you know? And when you think of it that way, you could re-envision how to not use time, but how to work with time, or how to be in a way. So you wouldn't, and this is my addition, it's not something he says explicitly in the book, but I think the idea is that you wouldn't try to
you wouldn't be so violent towards time, just as you wouldn't be so violent towards yourself. By violent, I mean that, for example, when you deal with money, you know, you can move around your money, you could put them in a bank, you could transfer money, you could do a lot of things with money, you can exchange money for lots of things, as if money is a non-entity, and that is quite correct. Money is a non-entity, and in a lot of ways, the way you're treating money and the way you're treating resources in general, water, food, whatever, in general, the way people treat resources is ruthless, right? It's quite violent the way you treat anything you consider to be resource. But if it's something that you don't consider to be resource, but as an end in itself, you would have a completely different approach to them. Let's say your friends, your family, people, or let's say just your art collection, whatever it is, like whatever thing you don't consider it as a mere resource, but as an end in itself, you're not going to be so violent towards them. And I think that's the central gist of the book. It's about treating time as an end in itself, which is to equate itself as your being, as part of your being, at least. And if you think of it that way, you wouldn't be so ruthless, right? You would be gentle, you would take it slowly, and you wouldn't try to conquer it. You wouldn't try, just as you wouldn't try to conquer your art, you wouldn't try to conquer yourself, your being. So I think that's a revolutionary idea, and there are many ways to interpret that. And one of the ways is what the author suggests, which is not to cram so many things in a given day. So it's a more of a practical outlook there. But I think it's just a great start, at least. Like, you don't have to take the practical aspects of the book so seriously. And I really, really like this quote from the book. I guess I don't have to do a separate episode after all. So what he says is that there is an alternative, the unfashionable but powerful notion of letting time use you, approaching life not as an opportunity to implement your predetermined plans for success, but as a matter of responding to the needs of your place and your moment in history. And I think it's marvelous quote. It's just so well written, and it makes so much sense to me. And I think this really ties into my mental shift after coming back from Finland, which is that before Finland, I know I'm making it too dramatic, but it's actually how I actually feel. Before Finland, we're, you know, in a faster mindset, I definitely think of time as something to be used, and therefore you get upset and anxious when things don't go the way they are planned, or if you are not doing enough in a day, and all sorts of things. But if you think of you not as a user of time, but as, you know, being sort of encompassed by time or enveloped by time, so, you know, seeing yourself as this dot and this just completely encircled by time, like all our environments, all the beings, oh my god, it's getting interesting, but all the beings and the existing things, basically all the existing things in the world are not just things, they are time. And let's say when you're sitting on a chair or you're in front of a desk, what's happening is not that you're using the chair or using the desk, it's that the desk and the chair and all the things around you are, I guess, manifestations of time, and these things are using you, and you are just in this place physically and metaphorically in history. So it's not just the chair and the desk and your bed or whatever, it's that at this moment in time, there is some sort of hidden purpose for you to be here. And the purpose is, you know, I think that's interesting, because normally, for any sort of productivity book or just general wisdom, they will tell you, you have to find a purpose in time, you have to find your purpose of living, you have to give yourself your life meaning. But I think that is very arrogant, and I think certainly this is what the author here is proposing, which is that we are not the master of time, we are not the people who could conquer time. Time is not something we could just master like that. It is beyond our reach. And in fact, if anything, time is our master. So that's what the quote is about. You know, just think of yourself as being used as time. And it's not about like a free will versus determinism debate. It's not that. But rather, you know, instead of saying that, instead of thinking yourself as the author of your life and that you are the one who has to come up with a meaning to your life and that it's going to make you happy. Instead of thinking that way, I think what he would propose that you should think of yourself as being drifted by the flow of time, and that your who you are and what you mean to the universe is going to be given to you. It's going to be something completely like passive. It's just there. It's not something you can find, not something you could just authorize for yourself. And I think, and this definitely is his view, because by the very end, I think he has this brutal quote about how we have realized that we will never make a dent in the universe. So basically, a lot of people are disappointed by themselves or feel like they are wasting time, they're wasting their lives because precisely that they could not sort of identify a true meaning or purpose in their lives. And maybe they resort to having children, they resort to having a family, but, you know, maybe quote-unquote career-wise, they are very much disappointed by themselves and how the society couldn't provide them a place, right? So that is that kind of disappointment sort of, it very much stems from the wrong notion that time is our resource and we can use it, and the better we use it, the more inventions we can come up with, and the more contribution we can do to the society, and the more contribution we do to the society, the more impact we have in the society as a result in this universe. But the author here is trying to say the complete opposite, which is that no one has any power whatsoever to make any impact or influence on the universe. No matter how hard you try, even if you're Shakespeare or Einstein, it's just completely minuscule or invisible or non-existent compared to the whole scale of the literal universe. And so it's just futile to try to think that you could be anyone like that. And this really speaks to me, because I naively thought that it would be great, you know, if I could be at least on the Wikipedia, but it's just arrogance. That's what it is. And even if you're on Wikipedia, it doesn't mean anything. Like, he's not trying to propose that nothing means anything, but he's trying to point out the very clear fact that no one whatsoever could ever really change the course of the universe, and that the Earth and the Sun and all of these planets, they are moving the way they are regardless of who lives on the Earth and what we do on Earth, right? So I think that's a really humble stance, and it's certainly a stance that it's a stance that I personally would like to adopt, not just because it curbs my anxiety, but I think just realizing that there's no point in your arrogance, not just because it gives yourself pain, but because by being arrogant, ironically, you are sort of subserving yourself, or rather you are minimizing who you are. You're treating yourself as a tool to a certain end instead of as an end in itself, which is to say that when you're so arrogant, you think that what kind of diet you have today, how much, how many things you've done in a day actually means anything. When you're so arrogant to think that, it actually does the complete opposite, which is you are actually projecting that you have so much power, when in fact you just end up disappointing yourself and realizing that you are more powerless than you ever imagined than someone who doesn't take this view on themselves. So in other words, if you're so arrogant to believe that how you use time can change the course of your day and slowly the course of the of human lives, if you're that kind of arrogant person, then 100% you're going to get disappointed because you can't change that. And you're going to feel that you are not important as a result of wanting to feel important. So, and by important, he doesn't necessarily mean the, you know, creating a light bulb or anything that is actually quite significant in the course of human history. Nothing like that. But just imagining that you could squeeze 15 things in a day, learn this language, do this chore, build a big family, and have so many fulfilling relationships. Even this kind of imagination should stay in imagination, because it actually is showing your arrogance that you could master time to do so much in a day. Some of these are my extension of what the premise of the book is about, but definitely it is it's something that's very relatable, and I think that that fresh perspective is very much welcomed in my life, at least. So there are a bunch of quotes in this book, you know. I think this might just turn into a book episode. It's good that I'm doing it so casually and end up being so like enthusiastic about it. It's quite good because I've always wanted to do a book episode, but then every time I think about making notes and sort of summarizing the points, it becomes quite daunting and I end up not doing anything. So I only have two so far and they're not very good, I know. But this one, I feel like, no, I can do okay with this one. And by the way, I'm sorry about the change of volume, because I'm just moving my microphone up and down, so it's a bit inconsistent. I wanted to do like I just don't like the microphone arm extending from the desk. That way it will be consistent, but then I can't really move. I have to keep the same distance from the microphone all the time. Anyway, point is, sorry about the change of volume. And also, I want to point out something, which is I never wanted this podcast to be so professional. That's why it's of such a low quality. It's because it's not my intention to make it into a commercial professional podcast. It's really for my personal well-being. That's why I started this podcast. It turns out to be quite interesting because it's quite different from writing a personal journal or recording on my iPhone. You know, I mentioned that I started an audio journal, but this is different from an audio journal. This is a project. So anyway, back to the book. I guess apart from the quote on letting time use me, there are a bunch of things that that are interesting. I guess we could go through some of the quotes and then we can just wrap it up after that. So one of the quotes, it says, "Once time is a resource to be used, you start to feel pressure, whether from external forces or from yourself, to use it well and to berate yourself when you feel you've wasted it." This speaks so much to me. This is what I was talking about. Once it's a resource, you think you have to use it well. And then once that thought intrudes you, you cannot help but to feel guilty when you feel like you've wasted this resource, right? Anyway. And then this is an interesting one that builds on that concept. It says, "Soon your sense of self-worth gets completely bound up with how you're using time. It stops being merely the water in which you swim and turns into something you feel you need to dominate or control if you're to avoid feeling guilty, panicked, or overwhelmed." This is also great. It's the same concept, right? So yeah, and then I think the swimming analogy is quite great, because when you're in water, you could think of yourself as mastering the water when you're swimming, or you can think of yourself as like just a mere thing in the water and just go with the flow kind of thing. So I think that's like two different perspectives on seeing time when you compare it to just being in the ocean or being encapsulated by water. So that's great. And then this one is another good one about treating time as a resource and what kind of problems that brings. It says, quote, "But ultimately it backfires. It wrenches us out of the present, leading to a life spent leaning into the future, worrying about whether things will work out, experiencing everything in terms of some later hoped for benefit, so that peace of mind never quite arrives." So this is something I don't really like about this book. You know, I this is very correct. It really is about focusing on the moment and just forgetting that, just stop conceiving the future, because that's also trying to, treating time as a resource rather than a being. But there's something I don't really like about this, which is that ultimately this is a book that is about living in the moment, and it just hides it so well. But really, if you think about it, this book ultimately is asking you to stop planning, to stop doing to-do lists, to stop growing your bucket list, to stop having a bucket list altogether. And he does say that somewhere in the book about the bucket list, but the idea is the same, right? Instead of living and as a way to move forward and to sort of carry yourself into like a better future, or rather a future that is better than what you're doing right now, instead of living in that way, you should just envision, well, you should stop doing any envisioning altogether and just live. It really comes down to this point of just living and being in the moment. And I just wonder why a lot of these self-help books, or yeah, I wonder why a lot of them ultimately end up at the same point. I like how the author arrives at this point. It's just that I'm curious why this is the ultimate message of all of these books. Anyway, carrying on, let's see. Yeah, and then he quotes something, which is a phrase that is quite useful to describe how a lot of people feel about themselves, which is this joyless urgency. I don't remember where in the book it's the context of that phrase, but I feel like that is an apt phrase to describe often how I'm feeling, right? You look forward to a new podcast episode from better podcast than this one, but you look forward to a movie release, you look forward to your trip, you book your tickets in advance, things like that. These are actually quite just, they are ultimately part of your joyless urgency. You feel like you have to do these things. They are on your bucket list. And when you do these things, there is like a 1 second moment of relief when you cross these things out on your list. But it's the process is actually quite joyless. And I can confirm that when I was sort of planning for the Finland trip, as in buying tickets for hotels and booking plane tickets, it's not really joyful. It's really just, oh, I have to do this, I have to do this. And yes, the trip itself, there is something about it, but that I like, but it has nothing to do with the planning, right? And that's it. That's how I think this is an apt phrase to describe a lot of things. Joyless urgency. Right, and the next quote is about letting time use you. I love this quote, it's so good. And then what else do we have? Oh my God. Okay. So let's read on. Okay. So here's a good quote about why it's not a good idea to keep a bucket list. So let me read, I guess the whole paragraph, it's meaningful. It says, quote, "So the retiree ticking exotic destinations off a bucket list and the hedonist stuffing her weekends full of fun are arguably just as overwhelmed as the exhausted social worker or corporate lawyer. It's true that the things by which they're being overwhelmed are nominally more enjoyable. It's certainly nicer to have a long list of Greek islands left to visit than a long list of homeless families left to find housing for, or a huge stack of contracts left to proofread. But it remains the case that their fulfillment still seems to depend on their managing to do more than they can do. This helps explain why stuffing your life with pleasurable activities so often proves less satisfying than you'd expect. It's an attempt to devour the experiences the world has to offer to feel like you've truly lived. But the world has an effectively infinite number of experiences to offer, so getting a handful of them under your belt brings you no closer to a sense of having feasted on life's possibilities. Instead, you find yourself pitched straight back into the efficiency trap. The more wonderful experiences you succeed in having, the more additional wonderful experiences you start to feel you could have or ought to have on top of all those you've already had, with the result that the feeling of existential overwhelm gets worse. Unquote. So this is the gist of the thing on the bucket list, but I think on everything as well, and it sort of feeds into the central premise of the book, which is that you, instead of like filling your list or making any list whatsoever, I think the author wants us to make a commitment and to just buckle down and just choose one or two things and just commit to the things, right? Instead of doing a diverse number of things, do one thing really, really well for a long time. And I think this is like definitely a new trend in terms of like self-help. Cal Newport, I think that's the nickname, has written a number of books about doing deep work and getting less distracted. So in a way, this feeds into that narrative. But I think an interesting point that to say here is really that pleasure is not countable, right? I think when you try to list all the things you want to do during your trip or just try to plan all the trips you want to do, that activity itself is really essentially no different from what you may do on a normal workday. There is definitely qualitative difference in terms of the fun things you do versus the work you do, but essentially you're doing the same thing. Essentially you are being very arrogant about conquering the world. And I really like this idea because in a way it sort of means that you sometimes I actually feel guilty for not enjoying my time, you know? And I think that's exactly the reason behind this feeling. I feel like I haven't done all that I could to enjoy more of my time. I feel like, for example, I have to cross out a lot of things on the things to do on TripAdvisor, for example, when I go to Finland. And that's totally unnecessary. And excuse me, that's why I don't like planning that much what to do when it comes to trips. It's just there are some necessary bookings. But other than that, I don't like the feeling that there are things I still have to do in that day because you should be traveling, not working. Anyway, so that's another nice quote. And the other thing, there's another thing about commitment. So the author definitely promotes marriage and, you know, settling down with one person. And he spends a whole chapter talking about how to not think of this as settling down, as settling. And actually, he says settling is a good thing. I don't remember the detailed arguments, but it's sort of along the same line of going deeply into anything is better than going broadly into a bunch of things. So that's his general stance on things. This, I don't know how I feel about this, you know. Maybe I haven't lived long enough to know if this is true or not, but this is definitely one stance he has, and it sort of makes sense given the general, the philosophy that he has over this whole book. And okay, there's another part I like about this book, which is that he wants to, he's against managing time very well. He's against trying to smooth things out. He's against making things as convenient as possible. So there is another chapter, half a chapter about against convenience. So it's quite interesting. Let's see. Yeah, so there's this thing about, like, he talks about friction and how life shouldn't be about eliminating friction, because friction should be like an essential part of life. So let me read another paragraph, okay? It works like this, quote, it works like this. In startup jargon, the way to make a fortune in Silicon Valley is to identify a, quote, pain point, unquote, one of the small annoyances resulting from the friction of daily life, and then to offer a way to circumvent it. Thus, Uber eliminates the pain, quote, pain, unquote, of having to track down a number for your local taxi company and call it, or trying to hail a cab in the street. Digital wallet apps like Apple Pay remove the quote-unquote pain of having to reach into your bag for your physical wallet or cash. The U.S. food delivery service Seamless has even run advertisements, tongue-in-cheek ones, but still, boasting that it lets you avoid the agony of talking to a flesh-and-blood restaurant worker. Instead, you need only commute with a screen. Sorry, you need only commune with the screen. It's true that everything runs more smoothly this way, but smoothness, it turns out, is a dubious virtue, since it's often the unsmoothed textures of life that make it livable, helping nurture the relationships that are crucial for mental and physical health and for the resilience of our communities. Your loyalty to your local taxi firm is one of those delicate social threads that multiply thousands of times bind a neighborhood together. Your interactions with the woman who runs the nearby Chinese takeaway might feel insignificant, but they help you make yours the kind of area where people still talk to one another, where tech-induced loneliness doesn't yet rank supreme. Skip a few things. As for Apple Pay, I like a little friction when I buy something, since it marginally increases the chance that I'll resist a pointless purchase. Convenience, in other words, makes things easy, but without regard to whether easiness is truly what's most valuable in any given context. So, unquote. So that's very interesting. And next paragraph, it says, contrary to the cliche, it isn't really the thought that counts, but the effort, which is to say the inconvenience. So he's talking about gift giving, right? It's about making the effort to meet someone, to give them the gift, things like that. So So I quite like this perspective, and I stand by, I really approve this message. I think one practical thing I changed is taking a physical wallet with me now instead of using Apple Pay. Not to save money or to like limit, to give a mental limitation on spending money, but I think in a way, I feel a bit creeped out initially when using Apple Pay, for example, by how convenient it is. It's just that, and auto, I never do like auto deductions from my account for anything, partly because I want to remember that these are the things I'm working for, right, every month. And so I really like this idea. I think the fact that our transactions have become so easy, It shifts your perspective on spending money and what it means to purchase anything. On the one hand, I do think that it means that people are starting to treat like day-to-day utilities to be just that. Like, it's not something that we should fight for so much. It should be like a smooth background in our houses so that we don't have to worry about them in our conscious mind. But on the other hand, I do think that it's not healthy to just take everything for granted, that you should have electricity and all of these things. I think, I don't know, it's difficult to really just have a stance on anything. But what I think he is right, that a little bit of friction doesn't hurt. And there's one thing that I just thought about, which is the fact that when you buy alcohol, you need to have your ID checked. I think definitely that is a nudge to make you less to make you more reluctant to buy alcohol, because it definitely affected me personally. I hate being asked for the ID because they, first of all, do this very rude glance of your face, and then decide if you're under 25. I really hate that moment. And so that's why sort of when it comes to beer, I tend to buy in bulk, not too much, but just like 5 or 6 at the same time for like the whole week's supply or two weeks supply. Okay. That friction definitely contributed to this kind of habit. Because if it's so seamless, I would definitely just buy whenever I go to the grocery shopping. So that's kind of nice. And another thing is just the friction thing, you know. I was thinking maybe it has to do with how it explains why Finland felt so slow because of the physical ice. It's the fucking ice. Ice is an actual friction, you know. It even if you're not walking, even if you've got a car, you, because of the cold, you got to slow down. You got to like preheat your car for sometimes up to 30 minutes before you go out. So in a way, you're not just, in a way, you got to plan a little bit more before you go out for the day, right? And then the friction just makes it like less easy to go for a quick grocery shopping or go for a quick, I don't know, bite to eat. It really increases the friction, physical friction at that. And so much so that you end up probably spending more time doing nothing, like just spending time with yourself in the house, getting some coffee for yourself. And obviously that could lead to social isolation, which is a whole nother topic, not for me, but basically I understand. I think this ice being and the weather being a physical friction, that's very, very important. I think it contributes to the opposite of a vibrant feeling, which is nice, which is something that I do like. I've lived too long in places that are humid and hot and just very welcoming, where everyone is very close to each other. But I think this lack of a friction could be a problem. And having this boundary, physical or otherwise, between people, between you and spending money, between you and doing more things in a day, I think that friction is very, very key. And I think it really changes your mindset. You know, if you every day you need to spend 30 minutes preheating your car, every day you have to shovel the ice, every day you have to, I don't know, do a lot of preparation just to get out, just to change the scenery, I think that really makes your life much more still, and being still is not, shouldn't be conceived as a bad thing. So I like that perspective a lot. So yeah. Right, so this is sort of the gist of the whole book, that we should just treat ourselves as being in like being worth being valued without having to do a lot of things. I think that's the gist of the story. And also, like, time should be an end, not as a means. And also, like, the cliche, live in the moment, which is to say, stop making lists, stop thinking that you can conquer the world, you could conquer your shortfalls. You know, I think that's a great way to look at it. And also about commitment. So there is another highlight, which is, which I do like as well. Let me see what it's about. Yeah, okay. Quote, we'll do almost anything to avoid burning our bridges, to keep alive the fantasy of a future unconstrained by limitation. Yet having burned them, we're generally pleased that we did so. Unquote. So this is, I remember this to being a chapter about commitment. So yeah, it's pretty self-explanatory. It's actually good that we have closed opportunities for our future than keeping options open. And I think that is also my personal problem as well. I sort of feel like I need to keep my options open, and then bam, before you realize you're this age and actually there isn't much you can do. And having all these options open actually just makes decision a lot harder. And when you don't make any decisions, you actually do nothing. Instead of a list of potential things you could do, the reality is that you're doing nothing. So that's kind of sad, but I like this point. I think this is really pertinent to, from a self-help perspective, and I think that's that kind of help I can accept. So it's good to burn bridges. That's the conclusion, I guess. And then finally, he spends a little bit of time on pay, ironically spending time, but he takes a few moments to talk about paying attention and really trying to focus, and this thing is not new that much. Let me read one quote. It says, attention, on the one hand, just is life. Your experience of being alive consists of nothing other than the sum of everything to which you pay attention. At the end of your life, looking back, whatever compelled your attention from moment to moment is simply what your life will have been. So when you pay attention to something you don't especially value, it's not an exaggeration that to say that you are paying with your life. Seeing this way, distraction needn't refer only to momentary lapses in focus, as when you're distracted from performing your work duties by the ping of an incoming text message or a compelling terrible news story. The job itself could be a distraction, that is, an investment of a portion of your attention and therefore of your life in something less meaningful than other options that might have been available to you. Unquote. So I am not sure exactly what he means here. I understand he says attention has to do with time, and time is you. So paying attention means paying with yourself, with your own life. This I understand, but he says the job itself could be a distraction. So I guess, he's going from small things to bigger things. First from the text messages, from irrelevant news, but then to your whole job could be a distraction. I love this one. It just means, I think, that start working for yourself and not for other people. I think that's the gist of the story here. So I like this advice, really. And also, there's a very crucial, a very personal like point. It says, which is to think of distraction as really not choosing. So when you're scrolling endlessly, mindlessly online, you're not choosing what to pay attention to. You're just like having things like fed to you and just suggest being very just nonchalant about what's being suggested to you. And so distraction is a way to avoid choosing. And I think this really weaves into his overall story or overall suggestion to say that we should choose, and we should, when we choose, definitely some options are not chosen, and we should stick with our choices. I think that's the moral of the story of the book in a way. Quote, the crucial point isn't that it's wrong to choose to spend your time relaxing, whether at the beach or on BuzzFeed. It's that the distracted person isn't really choosing at all. Their attention has been commandeered by forces that don't have their highest interests at heart, unquote. So this is quite important, which is that, you know, just get offline, I think. If you really think about it, that's really what it is about. But even if you get offline, I used to live in Taipei. I love this city, but there's one thing that always annoyed me about Taipei, which is, well, because of the high density, you just get bombarded with so much ad. Just every day walking on the street, there's so many billboards, it's very competitive, and all of them are trying to get your attention. So going outside on the streets is the same as really being online. Like you go anywhere, every corner there are billboards, and when you're waiting for the metro, there's just ads everywhere, and also there are like message and picture dense. So I didn't like that about Taipei. In London, surprisingly, it's a bit better, but I think overall it's just ads are not good. That I do testify to it. So other parts of the book, they're a bit more commonsensical about how attention is important, how distraction is not good, how it's okay to be bored and not to be constantly stimulated, and it's okay to have something that's unpleasant as unpleasant as boredom. It's okay to have friction. It's okay to not have the fastest in everything, to not be the fastest in everything, to get everything delivered to you, literally or metaphorically. It really is important to choose what you want to pay attention to. And here's a quote about boredom. It says, quote, "This is why boredom can feel so surprisingly aggressively unpleasant. We tend to think of it merely as a matter of not being particularly interested in whatever it is we're doing. But in fact, it's an intense reaction to the deeply uncomfortable experience of confronting your limited control." And I think this really weaves into the whole philosophy that time isn't something you can control, because even if you plan your day perfectly and you follow your plan perfectly, it doesn't mean you don't get bored. You know, it slips into your time every day somehow, and it happens. And then you feel the urge to scroll your phone for a little bit when you're just a little bit bored, and obviously it is not good, right? And he says, I quote, "Boredom can strike in widely different contexts, when you are working on a major project, when you can't think of anything to do on a Sunday afternoon, when it's your job to care for your two-year-old for 5 hours straight, but they all have one characteristic in common. They demand that you face your finitude. You're obliged to deal with how you experience is unfolding in this moment, to resign yourself to the reality that this is it." I love this quote because I think that is the fundamental problem when it comes to distraction. You're distracted because you don't want to be bored, really. So yeah, it's pretty self-explanatory. So this is, and also I like to take on finitude. I think we overestimate, we're arrogant in thinking that we can control a lot of things, and in a way that is saying that we have infinite power, but really we are finite and we're just so little compared to the rest of the vast universe. And I think obviously we know that, but we don't really live like we know that. We live like we think we can know everything in the world, we can consume as much as possible, and that is definitely not the case. And I think ditching that idea that we can control our time, we can control what we know, we could feed ourselves as much information as possible, I think we should ditch. When we ditch that, it might make yourself, you might be happier, you might slow things down, and being slow and being frictionful is actually not a bad thing. So yeah, so I read this whole book, I think, right before I went to Finland, and so it just feeds very well into the whole experience. And I think it's good that I'm revisiting this book again after the trip. I guess I'm gonna end with a quote, and I think this is a quote that you can take in various ways. So basically it's like near the end of the book, where he's using a metaphor to talk about like what kind of choices you should make for your own life. So let me go to the beginning of the paragraph. So quote, "The final principle is that more often than not, originality lies on the far side of unoriginality." The Finnish-American photographer Arno Minkinen Boys tried to inculcate this. The Finnish-American photographer Arno Minkinen dramatizes this deep truth about the power of patience with the parable about Helsinki's main bus station. "There are two dozen platforms there," he explains, "with different bus lines departing from each one. And for the first part of its journey, each bus leaving from any given platform takes the same route through the city as all the others, making identical stops. Think of each stop as representing 1 year of your career," Minkinen advises photography students. "You pick an artistic direction. Perhaps you start working on platinum prints of nudes, and you begin to accumulate a portfolio of work. 3 years or bus stops later, you proudly present it to the owner of a gallery, but you're dismayed to be told that your pictures aren't as original as you thought. because they look like knockoffs of the work of the photographer Irving Penn, Penn's bus, it turns out, had been on the same route as yours. Annoyed at yourself for having wasted 3 years following someone else's path, you jump off that bus, hail a taxi, and return to where you started as the bus start, as the bus station. This time, you board a different bus, choosing a different genre of photography in which to specialize. But a few stops later, the same thing happens. You're informed that your new body of work seems derivative, too. Back you go to the bus station, but the pattern keeps on repeating. Nothing you produce ever gets recognized as being truly your own. What's the solution? Quote, it's simple, Ming Kinnan says. Stay on the bus. Stay on the fucking bus. A little further out, their journeys through the city, Helsinki's bus routes diverge, plunging off to unique destinations as they head through the suburbs and into the countryside beyond. That's where the distinctive work begins. But it begins at all only for those who can muster the patience to immerse themselves in the early stage, the trial and error phase of copying others, learning new skills, and accumulating experience. The implications of this insight aren't confined to creative work. In many areas of life, there's strong cultural pressure to strike out in unique direction, to spurn the conventional options of getting married or having kids or remaining in your hometown or taking an office job in favor of something apparently more exciting and original. Yet, if you always pursue the unconventional in this way, you deny yourself the possibility of experiencing those other richer forms of uniqueness that are reserved for those with the patience to travel the well-trodden path first, unquote. So this is like a really interesting analogy of getting on the bus and stay on the bus. And then at the end, you'll find originality. And I think definitely you sense from reading the book that the author wants to promote a more traditional kind of life, and I feel like this book is sort of his personal project because he just had a kid and who's about 1 year old at this point maybe, and then maybe he wants to justify why it's great to be looking after this 1 year old, because maybe, well, he's probably an author all his life, and so he's like a creative type, and maybe he's thinking, oh my god, what am I doing with this 1 year old at 1 o'clock in the morning? Like my life, I'm wasting my time. And I think he actually mentions somewhere in the book this feeling that he's wasting his time. And I think definitely this is like a project for himself, where he's telling himself, look, it's okay to get married and go the traditional path. So I just find this quite interesting. And when I was reading, I was thinking whether or not he's right, because I don't think I agree completely with this mentality, but I do think that there is something valuable about having a little bit of patience, which is pretty self-explanatory. I mean, if you try more and more, you can definitely gain something out of that, or you're gonna see new things emerge out of the seemingly unoriginal path that you've taken. I agree with that. You know, I think it's good to invest in something a long time rather than trying so many things at the same time. But I don't think it necessarily means taking a quote-unquote traditional route, you know. So it's quite interesting to something to think about. Maybe I don't have a conclusion, you know. I still think that maybe if you have an original kind of life, you can still do something very original. Like something original might actually result from something original instead of what he suggests, which is that, you know, you stay on the bus and then eventually you'll find something new. You know, I think it's a bit lazy on his part to just merge different kinds of originality into the same page, because the photographer is clearly talking about art and photography. So I think in that realm, it's probably true that if you stick with something that's unoriginal and you practice and practice over and over again, you're gonna come up with your own style. Just like the pianist of today, they have to start with well, they all practice probably the same few concertos to start with, but then they develop their own style, right? So they're still playing the same old music, but something new comes out of their performance as they develop their own style. So it definitely proves the photographer's point. But then the author writes about like starting in a unique, like a boring path of having kids, remaining in your hometown, and then something will come out of it. I think this is probably just not true. I don't agree with that. I mean, there are just some towns, some hometowns that say that are completely bland and there's no way anything good or refreshing could come out of staying in that hometown, right? Also marriages, like there are just some marriages that are playing like waste of space and your mental, waste of space and your mental space and your time, really. And there's no way that we have to stick in a marriage or choose marriage for the sake of choosing the traditional and then trying to hope that something original and new will come out of the traditional. I think he shouldn't mess up the what the photographer is trying to highlight versus his personal choice of having a young child in this moment in his life. Anyway, I don't know what's going on in his life, but the point is, yes, I agree with that sometimes sticking with something to see how it goes, that definitely works out, but it doesn't mean that you have to choose the most unoriginal path in life to achieve something new. This is one point where I don't really agree with him. Anyway, so, and I guess we can end with this quote. So, blah, blah, blah. So some psychologists, I think, in Sweden, I think, observed this. He observed, quote, that what people need is a greater individual control over their schedules, but rather what he calls the social regulation of time, greater outside pressure to use their time in particular ways. That means more willingness to fall in with the rhythms of community, more traditions like the Sabbath of decades past or the French phenomenon of the grandes vacances, where almost everything grinds to a halt for several weeks each summer. Perhaps it even means more laws to regulate when people can and can't work, like limits on Sunday opening hours or recent European legislation banning certain employers from sending work emails out of hours. Okay, unquote. So I think this is a good point to sort of end. I think it feeds very well to the general theme that instead of managing your own time your own way, maybe it's not a bad idea to go with the flow and having a community which says that Sunday stores are all closed or you have to recycle on this and that day. And, you know, there's something about the community, there's something about how things have always been done that is quite powerful, because in a way it gives us ironically the structure that we ourselves are difficult to come up with. But at the same time, I think what he means to say is that it actually makes people happier, right? People don't necessarily want to decide when they get off work all the time for themselves. Maybe it's good to have a schedule, then you sort of have something already fixed for you, and then within that fixed framework you could come up with something very original indeed. I'm not sure about this. I mean, as I said before, I used to work as a teacher, and it's a bit annoying when you have to take your vacation during the summer, because why? And it would be great to have a bit flexibility here and there. I do see the bigger picture, which is that it's just lose your control, man. Like, it's not a big deal that sometimes when you get off work is determined by the company. It's not a big deal that you cannot decide every second how every second of your life is going to be spent. You know, it's great that there is some sort of being pulled or pushed by someone else. And I think that feeds into the theme, which is that you don't control time. Time and the universe control you. And it's okay to be used by time that way. So it turns out to be quite a long episode, and it's good for a once every 4 year phenomenon. So I guess this will be the special episode for this year. So I really like this episode in the end, because it's a great book, and Finland is great. Anyway, I hope you all enjoy the coming spring. Unfortunately, the ice is going to start melting. I don't know. But that being said, I'm just happy March and April and May and whatever. I'll see you next week, hopefully. Bye-bye.